You are listening to the Screenfish Podcast.
I'm your host, Steve Norton.
This week on the show,
we're talking about Moonlight,
a film that takes place
across three decades.
Let's dive right in.
Welcome to the conversation.
Welcome to Screenfish.
Welcome to the podcast. We are so honored this week to talk about Barry Jenkins' Moonlight, starring Mahershala Ali, Naomi Harris, Janelle Monáe, but the real stars are Trevante Rhodes, Ashton Sanders, and Alex B. Hibbard. Moonlight tells the story of a young man through three decades of his life and his relationships and how he forms his identity, but for a movie like this, we brought back the dream team once again. Welcome back to Audra Gray Choi and Shelley McVie. We're so glad to have you both back on to talk this film.
Great to be here.
We've already started with the question of identity.
So there it is. Who are we? But if we're going to talk about Moonlight, I realize that many people will be hearing this for the first time after Sunday, but I thought it would be important to talk a little bit about the Oscars, which are this weekend, and Moonlight has 8 nominations. I believe that is second to La La Land with 14. Ladies, is there a particular film this year through the Oscars that you feel especially deserving of the nomination? You know, there's a lot of people that are saying that La La Land is probably the one that's going to win just because of the momentum it's got, but is there a film that you feel like especially resonated with you this year?
You go, Audra. I have not seen enough of the movies.
You know what? I feel terrible because I don't feel like I've seen all of them to really comment. I think Moonlight is fantastic. Mm. I thought Hidden Figures was another. Here's a story that we haven't seen or heard. I mean, generally, we haven't seen or heard. And it's brought to light. So I thought that was another great film. La La Land, a modern day musical.
How did you feel about La La Land?
You know what? I wasn't sure if I was going to like it. When I think musical, I think back to, in terms of being on film, I think back to the older movies from...
Sure, Gene Kelly.
Yeah, and I was like, is this going to meet my expectations for film today? And it did. I thought it was great. Mm. I loved it. The music was great. It was fun. It was... You know, it told a bit of everyone's... Anyone who's an actor can totally resonate with, you know, what the characters were going through. So, anyways, I thought it was great. And it did take a long time to get that movie made, right? Much like Silence, I think Scorsese was...
La La Land, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, if I hear correctly...
No one didn't think they were... Yeah, they didn't want to pick that up.
I believe it was supposed to be Emma Watson and Miles Teller were originally cast in the roles, and they turned it down.
But I also heard that it was a movie that no one wanted to... They didn't want to produce it because they didn't think a modern-day musical was going to fly. So it took a long time for it to get before people and for them to take interest in it enough to really get made. That's what I think I could be wrong.
Does it deserve 14 nominations?
I don't think it does. Mm. I loved it, but I thought it was excruciatingly long. I was counting the minutes for it to be over. Huh. And I'm a huge musical fan, and I love singing, and I love dancing. And I was surprised, and I don't think they deserve the Oscars, the two leads, because I thought it could be almost any, and I love them. They were great in it, but I thought I could see any other two actors in Hollywood playing those roles. Whereas Moonlight, wow, I would have wished all those actors had been nominated.
Yeah, it's a funny question to say, what is the best picture? Every year at this time, they say, oh, well, who's going to be the best picture? And it's, what's your standard of best? Whether it's something that resonates, a lot of times they say, I mentioned to you just before we started recording, Honest Trailers this week did a hilarious one about the Oscar nominees, and it talks about sort of what, you know, why this film was nominated. And I think, for example, Moonlight, it talks about it checks all the boxes, like sad, a teenager in trouble, you know, trauma, all these things, and it goes through all that. But then, how do you compare a film like Moonlight to La La Land? To the only one I haven't seen this year is Lion, but to Hidden Figures, even the last time that you were both on was Fences.
Yes,
and my goodness, the breadth of scope, Hacksaw Ridge, It'd be one thing to say which of these is the best war movie or the best drama. You can sort of say these are the qualities of that genre, but I don't know how you say something is the best overall picture. That's hard to say. I don't know if I would say La La Land. I really loved La La Land. I fell in love with it. I love the music. I love where it went. I love the ending.
But I felt the ending was redeemed by the smile. If they hadn't smiled at each other at the end, I thought, oh, a musical, comedy, tap dance and fun thing that ended with sadness? No, that's not Hollywood.
Yeah, but see, that's why I liked it.
But they smiled at the end, so it was like, yes.
That was what I liked about it, is that the ending didn't go where... They sort of honored the nostalgia, but then they went more modern ending. It's like, if they hadn't done the ending, people would have just said it was completely mimicking the old style of filmmaking. But that's what I liked about it. I actually think it probably deserves the best direction. It definitely deserves Best Picture nomination. Now, after having seen a film like Moonlight, until I saw Moonlight, to me, La La Land was easily the best picture. I don't know if I could say it's the best picture of the year, but a lot of people think last year was sort of a down year for film overall. And it was an excellent film, but in another year where it was more competitive, would it be 14 nominations? You know, that's tied with Ben-Hur and Titanic. And that's a very broad conversation to say that this is in that company.
Sorry, which one is that?
La La Land is not. So, to me, I could see Best Director. I think Moonlight, personally, is the best picture that I've seen this year. And not just because it's the most recent.
I wish I'd seen all of the movies, because I wouldn't put Moonlight at the top. Because I felt I couldn't totally follow the story.
That's fair.
You know what?
And if you can't follow a story without watching the trailer first, and if I'd only known there were three actors playing that part, I would have been fine.
Yeah, I think I could see Moonlight being Best Picture because of the content. It's something that is relevant and that just, it provokes you to have these larger discussions.
Yeah.
And I think because it's so weighty, why I think it deserves to sit in that category.
Yeah.
Apart from the fact that, you know, photography was great and all these other things. Sure, absolutely.
It deserves the 8 nominations.
All of those things are great. But, I mean, I think that's what kind of gives it the edge. Having said that, I haven't seen a lot of the other ones within that category, too, so I think it's kind of unfair.
What's kind of funny, normally I haven't either, but this is the first year that I've been trying to podcast on them all.
Yeah.
So, wow. I missed Lion, but I did catch most of the other ones, and...
So these are your top two favorites, La La Land.
Yeah, Arrival is very close in there as well.
Really?
I absolutely adore Arrival. Oh my goodness! Now Arrival, it's out on video now. Arrival, I know some people that feel lost by the ending, but for me, it's without giving any spoilers, it's the ending that makes the film so unique. I absolutely adored Arrival. That was very close to at my number one pick. And I agree with you in Moonlight, because the thing that I love about a film the most is when I come away from it, if I feel like I have to unpack it. You know, even when I saw Fences, you know, we were going to talk about it, and there were lots of things to talk about, but I didn't have that same sense of, oh my goodness, I need to dig into this more than I did. To me, that's what Moonlight has, even more than La La Land. La La Land is much more fun. Much more fun. It's beautiful. It's moving. And it's got a wonderful story, wonderful performances. I think that she was far better than he was. I love him as an actor, but I thought that she was excellent.
I felt this one even more than Fences, because I was lost during part of it trying to figure out which character we were on. I wanted to sit through it twice at the theater, but I had another meeting that I had to go to just to figure out what I missed by not being able to identify where we were in the sequence. But I think it's the type of movie that some people are going to hate. I read some reviews afterwards.
You're talking about Moonlight now?
Moonlight. And somebody said, I'm giving it a 1 only because there's no category for 0 stars.
Ouch. For Moonlight?
For Moonlight.
Who said that?
And somebody else said... And somebody else said,
there's no moonlight in this movie at all. What moon?
What are they talking about? But somebody else said, this is what I wanted Boyhood to be.
I was going to say, isn't this a coming of age story?
Yeah, this absolutely.
This reminded me so much of Boyhood. Now, see, here we're already transitioning to Moonlight, which is fantastic because that's what we're here to talk about anyway. But yes, this film reminded me absolutely of Boyhood.
Now, I didn't see Boyhood, but I wanted to.
Yeah. Boyhood was more of an experiment. Otter's making a list.
Movie. Of all the movies that I've missed, I need to.
Very brave.
Boyhood was filmed over 10 years with the same people, and the boy literally grows up on screen.
Yeah.
So this is clearly not that type of film, but it also is that type of film.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense,
and they had the categories too, like they had the little titles as they did in Moonlight.
Well, we've already started, but for the record, Emma Stone is up against Isabel Huppert, Ruth Negga, Meryl Streep, Natalie Portman. So really, Huppert won the Golden Globe, so people could argue it's between them, although people love Meryl Streep, you never know. Since we're about to talk about Moonlight, just a reminder that this will be spoiler-filled, this conversation, because for us to discuss it, we need to be able to talk about all aspects of the story. But let's continue on. Moonlight, what did you think?
Oh.
Whoa.
Heavy.
Very heavy.
Whoa, we've got two woes.
Very heavy. And a tearjerker without shedding a tear.
Mm-hmm.
It was beyond heartrending. I cried a little bit in La La Land because there was the corniness of it and the sweetness of it. But this one, I felt really devastated by the end, and yet there was hope. He brings in hope at the end of it as well. A powerful movie, but not one I'd recommend to everybody.
Intimate. I kind of felt like it was also very simple, but yet there were very complex themes that were addressed in the movie. Simple in that they're like everyday moments, right? Lots of symbolism. Just in terms of images and the imagery that was shot. And not a lot of words compared to, I guess, coming out of our fences discussion.
Yes, it's the anti-fences, as this film is.
You know, but a lot of picture. A lot of being able to see it as opposed to telling it, which I absolutely love. A very reflective piece.
One of the things I appreciated about the film was its use of the camera. And the camera is very slow, and it's almost like it's allowing us to just sort of be in the moment. It's not frenetic. It's not cut, you know, we have to see everything all at once, and it's got to be, it's sort of slow pan, driving, long take, lots of long takes. It opens with an incredible long take of Mahershala Ali. I loved the way that it was telling the story. You're talking about visually. That's made me think of it. I was mentioning to you, ladies, before we started, that the film caught me totally by surprise because for some reason, I thought the film was going to be incredibly graphic sexually. And I got that impression from TIFF. Some point in TIFF, some reviewer or some passing comment, somebody said that. I don't know how, having seen the film now. But In contrast to that, it's interesting because, of course, 50 Shades Darker just came out a couple of weeks ago, and here's a film that sells itself on sex.
Have you seen it?
6 times. And I haven't seen it, but that's what it's selling you. That's what it sells you. And a film like this, I actually wondered if there would be, because it would make sense if they were trying to prove their great point visually. But the sexuality was quiet and behind the scenes. It was almost like this is a character piece. This is about the people and not about sex lives.
Mm-hmm.
And it was part of the story, as it is often in a drama. But it was so much behind closed doors. There was almost a reverence to it.
Except for that moment when he had that dream.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's true.
Not close doors.
That was not close doors. That's backyard. Yeah, that's true. His friend. His friend. Yeah, this picnic table and all sorts of things. But even, it was interesting, even that, though, it was a faceless person. Like, you could tell that this was his imagination of what that was like, what that was like and what that will be like. And I know that, for example, back in the day, I think I'm old enough now to use the term back in the day, when Brokeback Mountain came out, sexuality was important to them telling the story visually. And they showed it, whether it was homosexual or heterosexual sex, they wanted it to be seen. In this film, they wanted sexuality to play a part in a coming-of-age drama, but they didn't want it to be visual. It was not about graphic content. It was about character development. And I'm saying that to its credit. Mm. I love that. Because I'm always fascinated at how people use sexuality on screen. So given the fact that the only reason I'm even talking about it in this film is because that's what I thought it was. For 4 months, that's what I was under the impression that the film was about. But it is such a coming-of-age drama. Like I said, it reminded me of Boyhood. I absolutely fell in love with this movie. And as I have said before on this podcast, I've got quite a man crush on Mahershala Ali. He is in my top five man crushes, if you will. And I'm proud of it. I am proud to say it. It is who I am. I just want to sit down and have him read me stories. That's all I want.
And his character in this movie made you, except for his drug dealing.
That was my favorite part.
Made you love him even more, because I was trying to figure out what is his motivation for helping out this kid. Mm. Was he reliving his own? Because there was no connection. He just saw him there and...
That terrified me. I was terrified when, you know, when that relationship started, when he walks into, he sort of tears down the wall.
Yeah.
And walks into the room, and there's this boy, and I thought, oh no, it's going to be one of those stories.
One of those Shaq stories. Yeah.
And it's like, oh no, no, we're not going there. But they have such a wonderful rapport.
The father he never had. And, had to give up eventually, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I thought that was what you said earlier, Steve, about the sexuality not being right in your face. But I thought that, to me, enhanced the fact that this was a coming-of-age story, growing up, where sexuality is hidden, and you don't really know what you're doing. And I love that scene where they're standing around in a circle. And again, you don't see anything, but know they're showing off their junk to each other and measuring their manhood. And there's a couple of scenes.
Showing off their junk to each other.
Well, that I didn't misread that scene, I hope.
No, you didn't. I'm just laughing at how you you know, they're junk. Anyways, they're gone.
I thought there were a few times where there were circles where he was either in danger and surrounded by a circle of menacing people, or here, you know, just kids showing off, or a circle of friends. So I thought that was interesting.
I mean, okay, if we kind of jump into...
Let's go.
I was about to do
let's
that.
Let's go.
About, I mean, this story definitely speaks a lot into that.
For sure. There's a lot of conversation about what shapes who we are and the type of people that we surround. With that in mind, what extent do you think our environment actually shapes who we are? I mean, that's a huge question to ask, but it's certainly within this film.
To what extent? I mean, it certainly has a heavy influence. To what extent? I don't know if we can define that, but and it's certainly different for, you know, everyone. I think it's going to be different. And then what are we comparing that to? Like,
right, that's fair.
How would you measure that, I guess?
And compare it to La La Land. No, I'm kidding. <That's not
laughs> So, but yeah, obviously it has a huge influence. Culture has an impact on, you know, what kind of a person that you can end up becoming.
Yeah, I don't know the name of the character, Mahershala Ali, his character's name in the movie.
Juan. He was Cuban.
Juan, yes, from Cuba. I think he, in himself, shows the dual influence. Like, he is helping out Little. He's Little at that point. He's called Little. And you think, oh, this is going to be a very nurturing relationship, and this is what this kid needs. Mm. He needs a dad. And then we find out it's him that's actually not sold directly to Little's mom, but it's through his drug dealing that Little's mom is going downhill in her addiction. And you think, it's both and for Little. Like, you know, Juan is a good influence, but ultimately he was a bad influence because that's how mom got her drugs.
Well, it's interesting. It's such a complex relationship because indirectly, Juan is responsible for his mother, or not responsible because, but is supplying his mother's addictions. But at the same time, he almost gets self-righteous when he talks about how she should be raising him. Yes. And there's that really fascinating conversation where he and Naomi Harris are sitting there. Chiron's mom are standing there at Sari outside the car, and she says, "What are you gonna do? You're gonna tell me how to raise my kid? Are you gonna take care of him now?" And you almost get the sense that he's going to make this speech saying, "Well, yeah, I could do a better job than you," but he understands very quickly that he's responsible.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He absolutely understands, and I think he feels bad. I mean, I think
there was definite weight on his shoulders.
He feels the guilt of that, and you can see that in different places. But it certainly points to how complex human nature is, how we kind of embody both good and evil. Because at the same time, while he does play that role, being the drug dealer and how that impacts his mother, him and his wife were also a bit of like the role models, I guess you can say, in his life. And brought about a good influence. Sharon was allowed to ask questions. You know, what's a faggot? I mean, I'm sure that is not an easy question to be, but he felt comfortable enough to be able to ask that question. He was able to open up a bit to them.
It's one of his first lines of dialogue, actually.
They fed him. Yeah. They gave him money. You know, Teresa, right?
Yes, it is. I believe so.
Yes, you know, it is Teresa.
She was someone that kind of instilled a bit of a sense of pride or a sense of, you know, self-worth in him by calling him Chiron as opposed to Little. Mm. She's like, I'm going to call you Chiron then. You know, so, I mean, and so without that, it just speaks to how complex humans are.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes, for sure.
In our relationships.
It's interesting, too, because so much of Chiron's growing up is him trying to distance himself from his mother. And in some ways, he ends up patterning himself after Juan.
Absolutely.
By the end of the film. Yeah. And not just because of selling of drugs, but just takes on that, like he said, basically after the assault in the school, he says, I went to Atlanta, I built myself up from the ground up, I went hard. And his friend, or in Kevin, says to him, you know, this is not who I thought you would be, because this is not who I expected you to be. But who he wanted to be was rejected and literally beaten to the point that he ended up getting into a world that he wanted nothing to do with, to sort of invent himself and this sense of identity, create a new identity, if you will.
Yeah. Well, in order to function.
Yeah.
In order to survive. And, I mean, that is everyone's story in a way, right? Yeah. I mean, how many times were you told something growing up about who you are, and then you kind of, in a way, you kind of embody that? Because you may not have the tools to, you know, to develop who you believe or understand your sense of self to be. And so there's that struggle of how can I be who I really am in a society that made me tell me that I'm other than what that is.
Well, that's a great question to talk about, to talk about identity. To what extent are we defined, limited, or even formed by labels that are put upon us?
Mm-hmm. I think when his final role was as Black,
Yes.
And
I love that. There were three different labels for the film.
Little Chiron and Black. But I felt because his identity had become that of a drug dealer, and because I missed the fact that Juan had died, how did I miss that?
He shows up in an after credits scene. He shows up and says, hey, where is everybody?
I honestly thought, I honestly thought for a moment that Juan had come back near the end of the film because Chiron looks like him then. Black looks like him. He's got the gold teeth.
Mm-hmm.
He's got the black bandana.
He
he's riding the same car with the...
Is it? I didn't recognize that. It's the same car.
I thought, finally, my hero is black.
Except
and
it's his not...
His license plate says black.
Yeah. And then I thought, no, that's not Mahershala Ali. And I thought, oh, he's become him.
He takes on that role.
He takes on that role, and he looks like the guy who
was that
father to him.
And he's a man of respect in his neighborhood.
Yes.
You see him when he's driving the car. There are people coming in and out of his car.
Yeah.
And he is respected because of this character, this persona as Black, which the sound of the word in this context... You know, you've got Lil, you've got Chiron, which are softer words, and then you've got Black. This is my identity. This is who I am now. And you get this sense that, yes, he's patterning himself after the only father figure that he's ever had.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Don't you think it's interesting, though, that, I mean, you start, we're giving these titles, Lil, and then Chiron, and then Black.
Mm-hmm.
And in the middle there, we have his actual name.
Yes,
you're right.
As opposed to something that is different. And it's almost like that time when he was a teenager, he had a moment where he kind of owned in some kind of way who he felt he was.
Mm.
And he may have owned it and stood up for himself in a way that may have been appropriate, i.e. take a chair and knock somebody out cold.
Right. You felt that was inappropriate?
Yes.
But there was a sense that he was trying to fight for his life.
Mm.
Absolutely.
In more ways than one. And I especially, not that this was a great moment, but I mean, just to be able to see him when his friend was going to give in to that dare, I guess.
Mm-hmm. To fight him.
To fight him and to punch him down and punch him and try to keep him down. He stood up.
Yeah.
He stood up. He didn't fight back. That wasn't his intent, but he stood up. As if he's saying, this is who I am. I'm not going to play, you know, I'm not going to stay down. I'm going to stand up for myself.
I thought that was one of the great sorrows of the film.
Yeah.
He was asserting finally the fact
asserting
that he was Chiron and doing it in a very brave way because he knew he was going to get hit again.
Mm-hmm.
And then when his teacher asked him, or the principal says, you should lay charges, he refuses to.
Mm-hmm.
But then ultimately he does something, which we all went, yes, that kid deserves it.
But
that's what cost him going to prison.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's what led to him becoming...
It's really the beginning of beginning of Black, if you will.
Is
that moment after when he goes home, I believe, doesn't he stick his face in the sink? Isn't that what it is? When he does that first?
Oh,
and he sort of comes up, and after that he's storming down the hallway with purpose. He grabs the chair silently, just boom. But that is the beginning of the new persona. There is this moment that almost seems he puts his face in the water. It's almost like a baptism, if you will.
Yeah.
But he's created a new person. And he is not going... Because Chiron, the character Chiron, is not going to survive in this world unless he creates something new.
Mm-hmm.
Which is interesting because when the film ends, when it ends with Kevin, there's a cycle back to saying, who are you, Chiron? Who are you really?
Mm-hmm.
Is what Kevin says to him. Mm-hmm. And even Kevin senses... that he is lost now, that he's lost under this other character. You have grills now? Why do you have grills? And the grills, maybe I'm naive, but he's taking them off. I've never seen anybody take off grills. But so it's sort of like, this is my persona. I'm removing it now. I'm taking this off.
Yes.
It's almost like, taking off the jewelry and the watch and saying, okay, you're getting to the real me. But that moment where he hits him with the chair, where, yes, we pump our fist because we're blind.
Yeah.
It is the beginning of a fall for him in many ways. In many ways.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which actually, you know, you brought up a great question before we recorded about the issue of hypermasculinity, the impact of fatherhood and motherhood. What do you think in a film like this, what do you think it means to be a man in our culture, and how does the film address that? I told you, we got the easy questions for it.
Sorry.
This was your question.
What does it mean to be... I'm curious to know what you think, being a man.
I'm letting the ladies answer first.
Like, what is it to be a man in society? And then, I mean, the issue of fatherlessness, well. What is it to be a man in society? Steve, enlighten me. You tell me. No, seriously. And maybe obviously, this film speaks to some of that, where... there is still this sense of, you know, you gotta be hard, you gotta be strong, you can't cry. I mean, there's a little bit of that still happens. Maybe there's more. Maybe you can say that.
If we're talking the hyperman in this movie, it's that stereotypical stuff. You have to have the big car.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the boombox. Yeah. And...
certainly
make money and be pumped. Like, he was working.
I don't know what
working.
It's like to make money. I'm a pastor. I don't
he
know.
He was no working out at the end. He was muscular like Juan had been.
Yeah.
And before he'd been this cute, skinny kid.
Yeah.
But Kevin was a much better model of nurturing manhood. Yeah. I mean, he made him that meal at the end. Mm. He had to take off his grills.
Let's talk about that.
That was an interesting...
when he was a kid, I mean, I'm just looking at Kevin growing up.
Did his
up.
Mother ever make him a meal? I don't know that we ever saw that.
No, Teresa and Juan. Teresa and he ate at the table of Teresa and Juan.
Yes.
He never ate with his mother.
Yeah. Yeah, but go. I see wisdom about
to
be said.
Here she goes.
When you talk about when we look at Kevin growing up, just the way that he would front about having sex with all these girls and that girl in the stairwell and like, you know, even when he was
younger.
Was
that Kevin saying all that?
Yeah, that's Kevin.
Yeah, I was getting those
Kevin.
Actors.
That leads to the dream. That leads to the dream that he has with her
dream.
At the picnic table.
Okay.
Because that's what he imagines Kevin to be like.
Yeah, and teaching Chiron how to fight so that he wouldn't be soft when he was younger and all of that, right? And then even still, moving from that, you know, very intimate moment where they're having this sexual encounter to the very next day where he's beating him up to cover who he is and how he feels in order for him to look cool and to get along and to be able to connect with the other guys. I'd say that a lot of that obviously still we still do that.
I guess Kevin had learned how to survive.
Mm-hmm.
He was the softy inside, but he knew you couldn't do that at school.
Look
without
at Trump and his talk about women and
so maybe in a way Kevin
yeah.
I shouldn't go there.
No, we can go. The last two people I've had on the podcast have ended up there, and we've always the US political situation.
And he's the leader of the what? Like
so not much anymore.
No.
So it's obviously, you know, embedded in a lot of cultures.
Well, I think the idea of masculinity and manhood, you know, I wanted to keep my mouth shut while you guys talked about it first, while you ladies talked about what it means to be a man.
Clearly.
Yeah.
Obviously, no.
What's it like? One of the things that I've come to realize is that, and here's the great secret nobody knows. Culturally, you look at it and there is this sense of people in the 80s, you look at the 80s action hero, the rescuer, the dominant, the powerful, the Schwarzeneggers, if you will. And this is actually I read a fascinating article, I can't remember where, about Trump being an 80s guy, and he wants the world to be an 80s world. He still lives in that 80s society. He is somebody who takes power, and power is a high value, and crushes other genders and other race and all these things underneath his feet, because this is the 80s mindset, the strong, powerful male. There is then a sense in the 90s where that sort of got flipped on its ear. And, you know, there's sort of an emasculation of the American male, and the man became a buffoon as the female characters in sitcoms became much stronger and more authoritative, because they wanted to bring an equal balance, but it was less equal. It became the man was the idiot, you know, and it sort of went the other way, and there needed to happen because it was so far in one way. But it, you see that tension in a film like this, and the truth is, to say what is a man, culturally, nobody knows. I think that's why you see in a character like this something that's so fascinating to me, where Chiron, as a young homosexual African-American teenager, which is a ton of oppressed characteristics on a broad cultural scale, mm-hmm. all wrapped up in one identity, and he takes the brunt of it. He wants to be who he is, which is this character, and yet he has to feel like he creates something new so that other people, he meets other people's expectation of what it is to be that man, you know? So mm-hmm. he creates this persona of black. He's got the gun in the car. He's got the grill on his teeth.
That's right.
And he's selling drugs. He's working the corner, I think, is the phrase he uses.
And playing classic man in the car.
Playing classic man in the car. And he builds on these old stereotypes to keep people from getting at who he feels he really is. Mm-hmm. So what does it mean to be a man? I think that nobody actually knows, but there's a safer cultural protection in being this hyper-masculine or image, if you will. Safer in the sense of people seem to get it. You know, that's what a man is. Mm. But there are so many things about him that even he didn't understand. You talk about it being a coming-of-age drama. He didn't understand his sexuality. He didn't understand how he fit in or why these guys were beating him up.
I don't think anyone understood.
That's true.
I think, you know, everyone was really struggling with that whole issue of identity. Mm. I mean, even Juan himself, being that he felt the guilt and the weight of what he was doing, I don't think he wanted to do that either. That's just the life that he, mm-hmm. again, had to take on because that's what he was accustomed to, maybe. That was what he felt was his only option. Mm. Because you did see some good in what they were doing. You saw the good coming out of them and wanting to, in a way, maybe even shelter him from, you know, all the negative aspects, but wanting to nurture him with all the good things so that he would have something moving forward.
It's funny. In many ways, Kevin is the most nurturing person in the entire film. He's not a caregiver in terms of safety. Juan was a protector.
Yeah.
Yes.
He's not a caregiver. Teresa's a caregiver in the sense of she keeps him safe. She feeds him. She nurtures him. She's more of a nurturing mother force. And his mother is an interesting person, too. I mean, I found Kevin was the one that helped him to feel the most human. Mm. That was how I felt.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
By the end of the film. And I was waiting for the turn. I was waiting for it. I watched this film on my laptop, and it said 10 minutes left, and I'm like, there's no way that this ends well. He hasn't seen this guy in 10 years. They had a casual encounter on the beach when they were teenagers, mm-hmm. and yeah, he was bullied into it, but he beat the snot out of him, and now he's in his apartment. I'm thinking one of two things is going to happen. Chiron's going to make a move, and he's going to deck him, or Chiron's going to freak out and he's going to deck him. This is how the last 10 minutes I'm like, this is how it's going to end. And it's going to end Chiron out in the night and he's staring up in the moonlight. And this is how the film's going to end. But it ended on this moment of quiet.
Yes.
Sort of wholeness. Like, it's really interesting. I was waiting the same way as I did with Mahershala Ali, waiting for the evil to pop out because I just expected it to, but it ends on such a quiet note.
I really liked the way that it ended.
Yes.
I mean, I'm still trying to gather my thoughts on what I really thought about it, but it's like we all need that space. Mm. I mean, they were just holding each other, right? Mm.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and then he looks up to the moonlight.
title!
But, yeah, just that moment where they're holding one another and just a sense of safety, a sense mm-hmm. of, I want to say something like acceptance or something like that, but just a grace. Sense of, maybe that's a better word. Yes. Mm. Grace. there was just something about that moment that made me go, oh, we need more of that.
Mm.
We need more of that.
Mm.
Whatever that is, we need more of that. And I like how you use the word grace to describe it in a way.
It was not predictive of what the future was going to hold for anybody. But I think grace covers a lot of things. But it gave me hope in a very, very, very heavy movie.
Mm-hmm.
I could see the people in the movie around me. There weren't that many because it was late afternoon. But they were down.
Mm.
But I thought that scene, I just thought Kevin was a beautiful character.
Mm.
And his acceptance and love of his friend, who mm-hmm. he saw had a miserable life the last 10 years. And the scene with the mother.
The last one?
Yeah. It was awful because she was...
Forgiveness and repentance.
Forgiveness and tears and the fact that he was hearing his mother loved him.
Mm-hmm.
I was waiting for him to lose it. I was shocked. You want to talk about a grace-filled moment.
Mm-hmm.
He did not want to admit that he heard it. But there's this, it's just such a beautiful moment where he says, yeah, I hear you, Mama. And, I mean, with all the hell she's put him through, he has every right to
hate her. Which he did.
He did.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I don't even know if he does at the end. I don't know if it's a moment of forgiveness or a moment of recognition that you're broken, but I do know you love me. She doesn't say, I want you to forgive me. He says, I know you love me,
mm-hmm.
which is huge.
I think it could be the start of a turning point,
mm-hmm.
but to turn and walk a new way is a difficult road.
Mm.
But it certainly points to, as you were saying, hope that things could begin to heal.
Mm. Maybe healing is the word.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
A moment of healing there.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's even the word at the end of the film is healing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because two people that were very important to him have now given him a way forward. His mother has basically asked for his forgiveness, and his friend that he has held a crush is not the right word, but he'd not encountered anybody else sexually.
Yes.
Tell me about that decade. Line at the end of the movie when he's like, you're the only man that has ever touched me. And I know I was like, when he said, I was like, And then...
See, that was when the turn was going to happen. That's what I was waiting for them to say, what?
And then my mind instantly went to, my God, what would have happened if he had a father? If his father had been present?
Mm.
What would that have looked like? How would that have shaped him? Like the issue of fatherlessness.
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, you could talk about that. You could.
You can't drop a bomb like that and say, okay, you deal with my mess. No,
you can talk about that. But just, I mean, it just broke my heart when he said that.
Because the word father is never mentioned in the movie.
You're absolutely right. He never mentioned it. Because it is true, Mahershala Ali is not his father. He becomes a father figure.
Yeah.
It's interesting. We just came off a retreat with the youth as a pastor, and our theme was families. And the first session that we did was on our notions of fatherhood and how it shapes our understanding of God. And the conversations that were had by asking one simple question was, what's your relationship with your dad, and how does it shape your view of God? You should have heard some of the things that people were saying. It was unbelievable, because this idea of the role of the father in one's life. And I think, again, when we think of that, what do we think of? Do we think of the traditional model of what the, you know, Ward Cleaver dad, or just somebody who's in the home? But I think what we see is that our understanding of the term father does shape our understanding of the world. It does shape our understanding of God, as does mother. As does mother, our understanding of that term and what role that plays.
Mm-hmm.
And in many ways, Chiron was looking for parents,
mm-hmm.
both.
Yes.
No father physically present. Mother was barely present.
Mm-hmm.
But our understanding of parents and it does shape our understanding of relationships and one another and of course ourselves.
Yeah. I guess my question is God's love versus the love that we see in the world, and how that gets exemplifies in our relationships.
Mm.
How we say "I love you," "I love you," "I love you," and how it actually plays out in the way we behave and act towards one another.
Mm.
And in this movie, my thought was, there's love, but it's so broken, it's so fragmented, it's so fragile, and at sometimes you're getting a sense of it, like it's almost like the love's on the other side of the wall and you're trying to get to it but you can't. And I just thought it was a really good depiction of how love can play out in the world around us, yet it's so much bigger than that, and fuller, but oftentimes we don't really see it, and I thought that it really showed it really well.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think it comes through the cracks. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure we can experience God's love if it's not mediated through people, because, I mean, you could see a nice sunset, and I guess that you might know God loves you, but if it's not mediated through anybody, you're never going to understand God's love, because God's love would be so powerful it would kill you if he had to reach down from heaven every time. But I thought in this movie, love does come through those little cracks. Like, who would have thought this kid running from his little peers at school and hiding in an abandoned building, that this big drug dealer dude is going to tear down a wall and find him? Mm. Like, I thought that was a wonderful vision of what love does, because it can scare you. Because the kid was obviously scared, but...
I was scared.
I was scared, too. But he knew enough to go with him. He wouldn't talk, but he knew... He went with him.
Well, and Juan says to him, "You can stay here if you want, but I'm going to get something to eat. Do you want to come with me?"
Yeah.
"You can stay." He gives him the choice. He doesn't force it.
And maybe Juan saw a little bit of himself because of that little scene with them on the beach when... He talks about how he hates his mom, and Juan said, "Well, I hated my mom too, but now I miss her more than anything," something like that.
Well, and it's interesting too, you bring that up, because doesn't Juan say that she calls him Blue? And I think Chiron says, "Is that your name? Is that who you are, Blue?" And he says, no. Mm. Like, there's a sense of, no, I'm not who my mother said I am. I'm not Blue.
And then he says at some point in time, "You're going to have to define who you are."
Yes.
Yes, you're right.
Right.
I'd forgotten about that moment. You're absolutely right.
Mm-hmm. Some point in time, we all have to do that.
Yes.
I liked that love in this film was portrayed in relationship, little r as opposed to capital R.
Yeah.
It wasn't about the quest for the boyfriend or the girlfriend or the dating relationship, even the quest to the sexual relationship. It wasn't about that, as so many films end up becoming.
Yeah, yeah.
This was about the quest for being loved. And, you know, I think you're absolutely right. That love comes through one another, through people.
Yeah.
And we see that in those moments of grace breaking in Chiron's life. And there is healing because of all the damage from the times he didn't get love. He got the opposite. He gets called names. Those names become labels, which become limiting to who he is. And that's, you know, that was the interesting part for me with the fact that they had the three segments. In some ways, labels are very limiting. They say this is who you are, and they don't really give you the opportunity to flesh it out any further than that. It's like, you're little. That's who you are. You're little.
Mm-hmm.
And that's who you are to me, and that's... At one point, when he comes in the second segment, he says, the guy comes into the classroom, and he says, "Hey, little," he says, "don't call me that." Like, this, he doesn't want to be known as little. "My name is Chiron. That's who I am." But that love that he finds helps bring that to completion, I suppose. Maybe that's the way to describe it. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
When he brings it to completion, and what do you mean?
Well, I think there's a sense of wholeness and healing at the end of the film that comes after that moment of grace and love breaks in, especially in the character of Kevin. It's not just about their past. It's about Kevin encouraging Chiron to be who he is. Mm-hmm. You know, Kevin's not going to put up with the facade. He says, who are you? And that's actually a loving question. Mm-hmm. That's a very loving question. Because mm-hmm. mm-hmm. it isn't said in a negative tone. It's in a nurturing, come out and let's see who you are sort of way.
Do you think Kevin found who he was?
I think Kevin is one of the ones that has the biggest sense of who he is throughout the film.
And he was going to be, he was a father, and he was going to be in that child's life, because he does talk about that.
Yes, he does. He has a kid.
Oh, there's hope for that next generation, because one of the loving characters in this movie is going to make sure that happens for the next generation.
And he says he's found peace. He's come to a place where he's fully okay with who he is. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's where I would argue that he was probably the most fleshed out and most character of greatest, deepest wholeness, I guess.
His vocation came through suffering, too, because he was in prison or jail or something.
Yeah.
And that's where he learned he had the gift of cooking.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that there's a difference between being at peace with where you're at versus who you are or who you perceive yourself
to
be?
Ooh. Man, this podcast is going to be 6 hours long. No, that's a great question.
I mean, in some ways you could say, well, Kevin's working in a greasy spoon. You couldn't really tell whether he was still together with the child's, with his girlfriend, wife, whatever.
Yeah, I didn't get the sense that they were.
But they were certainly going to work together, and he might have been, worked together bringing up this child. And yet, you looked at his relationships. He knew the people's names that had come in to the diner.
Hmm.
Like, there was a lot of relationships going on there. So it wasn't a high-paying job like being a drug dealer, but there was peace and contentment, I think.
Right. And I absolutely get that there's a sense that he's in a much better, healthier space than Chiron is. So then he's able to pose that question. But society might look at that and be like, yeah, that's where you want to be. You want to be in that space, and then that's it. Like, and I guess that's why I bring up the question of where you're at versus who you are.
Well, you know, it's funny. We just did The Founder, and that film is just imbued with the theme of ambition and striving to accomplish.
Mm-hmm.
And this film is the polar opposite of that in every way, shape, or form. Mm-hmm. So this idea of being where you're at seems like such a it's more of a location. So you can be content with your circumstances and hate who you are.
Yeah.
I would say that you can be in a place where you are absolutely absolutely love, you know, love life. You got the money, you got the car, you got all this, but you can't stand your life and you can't stand who you are. I think it is far more healthy and holy. I think that's, you know, as a pastor, I see that as a gospel-infused thing, to get that sense of spiritual wholeness and be okay with who you are. Because if you're okay with who you are, then you can usually deal with where you're at far more effectively.
Mm-hmm.
You can be in the worst circumstances and hate your circumstances, but still have a sense of fullness.
Okay, this is going to take us much more deeper into the question. And I don't know if we want to go there today, but then I think as you're talking, I'm thinking of, how do we know who we are?
Well, thanks for being on the podcast. <I don't know. laughs> Ladies, great to talk to you.
This is hour two, the philosophy of love and acceptance.
I love it. That's a great question.
I'm talking about the issue of identity and where we.
It's a great question.
You know, once we become comfortable in life, and we're great with, you know, the circumstances that we're in, does that make for who we are? Is that it?
I think that's the first step, because today is all we've got. We could walk out and be hit by a car tomorrow. So if I'm not accepting of who I am today, I don't think God can actually work with me, because it's another, if we're talking spiritually.
I'm not talking about accepting who you are.
Okay.
I guess accepting, well, let's, a different
being
way
content?
Of putting it. Accepting how you perceive yourself to be. versus is there something else? Is there something else? Is there, like, for example, you know, you may be comfortable being the
drug dealer.
A drug dealer.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this is how you portray manhood, but is there something else?
Or the edit that out.
Oh, no, I'm leaving that one in.
You know,
I see what you're saying. This goes back to sort of what we talked about with fences as well, if I remember correctly, because we talked about where does the standard of goodness lie.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And we talked about that in Troy's character, because Troy is constantly dissatisfied with him, and we talked about whether or not he was a good man. I think that there's a sense of... I think if we're ever the standard, there's mm-hmm. a flaw. So, for example, if we're just okay with who we are because it's who we are, and that's oftentimes where society ends, be okay with who you are because who you are is good. That's who you are. Yeah. and therefore it's good. But then what we've done is we've made ourselves a standard of goodness.
Yeah.
Now, I think that obviously, as a pastor, I believe there's a strong case for us to understand that standard of goodness lies in God alone and outside of ourselves. So... being okay with ourselves doing evil, if I'm a serial killer and I'm okay with the fact that I'm a serial killer, that doesn't mean that I should be, because I'm doing something that is not good. But
was Juan evil?
Well, thanks for coming on the show, guys. Ladies, it's love to chat with you. Wow, I hadn't made that connection, but I think he was a good man doing a bad thing. And I don't think he should have been okay with doing the bad thing. Mm. I don't think he should have. And I don't think he necessarily was when it hits home with that he's causing the pain of the child that he is working with.
Yeah.
When he realizes the impact he has mm-hmm. on Chiron's mom,
mm-hmm.
it changes his view of what he's doing. But he's in too deep.
Yeah.
But I think that he was a man who hadn't considered the moral implications of what he was doing.
Mm.
And I think maybe he was too okay with what he was doing until that moment.
Until that moment.
Things change. Yeah. But I think he was a good man. And then he died. Which you didn't even know.
I missed that.
And I think we all need those moments.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, where we've become so incredibly comfortable with ourselves, thinking this is who we are. We need those moments that kind of knock us out of our echo chambers.
Yeah.
I guess.
I think that's easier when you're in a better place. Like, I think Juan was saying something true to little Chiron when he said you have to decide who mm-hmm. you're going to be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But I think that's not a full answer. I think you have to get to that point where, I guess this would be philosophy-wise or psychologically-wise, where you're not putting yourself down, you're not letting people label you, because then you're able to hear the gospel. Mm. Then you're able, if you're not even at that point, you have to get to that point to be able to hear better. But to think we are actually self-made people is BS.
Yeah. And you know what? I was just thinking about this based on this conversation. We are talking about identity as though it's a place you're at. Identity is constantly being shaped and formed throughout our lives.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
We see it. This film tells that story. It's constantly shaped and formed.
Mm.
Spiritually, emotionally, physically, personally, relationship-wise, our identity of who we are. There may be key characteristics and aspects that remain with us through our lives, but I am a different person than I was 10 years ago, than mm-hmm. 20 years ago. Thank goodness I'm different than I was in my teenage years. But identity is a moving target. It's in the same way, you know, in the church we talk about spirituality as a thing that you've accomplished. It isn't. It's a moving
mm-hmm.
thing. It's a shaping process. It's a journey and a relationship with you and God.
I like maybe not moving, but a living thing.
Mm. Ooh, I like
living,
that better.
Yes.
It becomes more alive.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, yeah, I like that word.
I like that word. I think that this really is a good spot for us to transition. In all honesty, I am loving this. Yeah. Loving this conversation.
I just realized what time it was.
But this conversation has been absolutely fantastic. I've absolutely loved it. But ladies, we do have to end it at some point. Yes. This seems like a good place to do it. Let's do Screen It or Skip It. Moonlight, Screen It or Skip It?
Screen It!
Screen It.
Screen It.
I'm a little surprised you said Screen It. I'm a little surprised.
My friends that I would say that to, though, I would say that with qualifications. Be prepared. Mm. It's not a musical comedy.
Moonlight, everyone loves the moon. No, the wheels have come off. I can't contain you two. No,
yeah.
It's absolutely a Screen It for me. It surprised me in ways that I did not see coming. I guess that's what the definition of surprise is. Mm-hmm. But the film is just so nuanced,
mm-hmm.
and it's both bold and subtle. In a number of ways, mm-hmm. and a boldness in the subtlety. I was stunned by it. It's absolutely fabulous. Definitely a Screen It for me. Ladies, thank you both again. So wonderful to have you on the show.
Thank you,
Steve.
Wonderful.
Thank you, Steve, for inviting us.
Mm-hmm.
It's so much
fun.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
We love
and we'll be
you.
Placing our Oscar bets right after we go off the air.
Oh, good. All right. Okay. Well, how can our listeners connect with you, Shelley?
I'm at Shelley McVie on Facebook, just the way it sounds, and also at St. Saviour's Anglican Church, also on Facebook.
Great, Audra.
Right, and you can contact me through Adonai Creative Arts Initiative in Durham Region, at acaforestbrook@gmail.com.
Great, excellent. Also, we have some exciting information for those of you that may be in the Toronto area. Imago is an organization that encourages a relationship between faith and the arts, and they have a fabulous mini-conference coming up on April 3rd and 4th. It will be down in the Tiff Bell Lightbox, and the event will focus on post-secular cinema. Director Paul Schrader is going to be there for a Q&A. There's going to be some great workshops and some fantastic conversations. For anybody who is interested on more information on that, they can go on the Imago website, imagoarts.org, and it looks like it's going to be a fabulous event, so we wanted to let you know about it. They're friends to the show, and we think it's an exciting project to be a part of. Also, we will be back in 2 weeks with our next episode focusing on Hugh Jackman's swan song, Logan, as the character of Wolverine. Also number 2 on my man crush list. So we will be back in 2 weeks and every 2 weeks after that. But as always, we started the conversation. This was Screenfish. Because it should have been, that's how I would have spelled it,
yeah.
Except with an O-N-E.
I was writing all this in the dark.
I was too. I tried with the iPad.
Oh, did you feel like the worst person in the world?
Horrible. I was sitting in a corner, and then there was no one behind me at first, and then at the very last minute, a couple came, and they sat right behind me, and I was like, oh, why'd you do it?
I know. I put my phone on, and I turned the dimmer all the way down, and I'm sitting, yeah. And for La La Land, I was in the thing, and it was a packed theater, and people just go, whoop. You know, and they come on the screen, don't be a Tommy Texter. I'm not a Tommy Texter.
I'm a critic. I'm here from the Toronto Star.
That's right. I'm just making notes.
You just don't recognize me.
That's right.